exploring the importance of having the right skills to succeed. This is Skillfully Speaking, supported by Babcock International. In this special compilation presented by Skills Ambassador Jackie Grubb, we focus on the importance of education, career choices, and technology. Let's start with education. Education provides the foundation for building successful careers and lives. Later, we'll hear from James McKenzie Blackman, CEO of Theatre Royal Plymouth. But first, former MP Robert Helfen is a big supporter of the work undertaken by further education institutions. He spoke to Jackie about why education is important.
How do you believe a strong educational foundation actually contributes to the development of essential skills in individuals?
One term I always hate, by the way, is the term soft skills.
Yeah.
Because I don't believe any skills are soft. Skills are incredibly hard. You need both skills and knowledge. And we always have this false argument in our country about knowledge and skills. And I've always said that you need to absolutely learn the names of fish. You need to learn the biology of fish and nature, but you also need to teach people how to fish. So what I've always believed is marrying both knowledge and skills, which is very much part of my philosophy. And to me, education and skills is everything because it can solve so many problems. If you are given a good education, it means you can get on the ladder of opportunity. It means you have both the knowledge and the skills to do further training, but also to get jobs. If you get a job, you mean you get security, prosperity for yourself and your family. So there's nothing better. To me, education is the greatest tool for social justice that we have. There's nothing more important. And that's why FE colleges are so important. They're not just places of skills capital, they're places of social capital as well. And you're absolutely right to say that they are community assets, because where they are, they're absolutely fundamental to the community. And where you have good FE colleges, you always note that that community is stronger and actually unemployment is less in those areas. And because the young people are being given, even in difficult economic times, the training and skills that employers need.
What would you be saying to all of those students out there then? Because we all know that our brains work very differently. Some of us are really good at memorizing and taking exams and doing well, but actually others take a long time and their brains work differently in more of a practical way. So any advice for those, Robert?
Yes, I do think some exams are important. I'm not against exams. I do think that to have to test yourself a quick memory recall is worth it, because you do have those kind of situations in life. I mean, as a minister, suddenly I'll be told I have to do a debate in the Commons. There might be very short notice. And, you know, you learn those skills growing up, those memory recalls. I do think that is important. People have to do that in all walks of life. But I'd say to students, people do have different brains. I tend to be a better visual learner. Like when I'm talking to people, it goes in my head much, much more. That's why I love going on visits. I go around to colleges and universities almost every week.
Yeah.
And I learn so much. And it sticks in my head much more than all the 5 million. I've got my wonderful officials here, but the 5 million forests they give me to read every day, basically, paper. But it's not easy. You have to do these things, but you can only do your best. That's what I'd say to students. And we do have to do things like maths and English because they are so central to everything we do in life. But other than that, try and do the things that you love doing and that you're best at, because then you'll feel much more happy and contented. And, you know, if exams stress you out, they're still important, but I completely get it. But just get support from your friends and your family and try and do as much as possible. So, as I say, specializing in the subjects that you enjoy the most. So I try to put all my energies in, surprise, surprise, history and politics and English literature and language. Although, of course, maths and English, maths particularly, which was my weakness, I think to this day is incredibly important.
You raised £20 million for the Lyric Theatre Hammersmith's Capital Project.
I didn't go out and raise £20 million by myself. I did it with a colleague or two. What I was doing then was predominantly leading all of our work with young people, mostly working with young people who were not attending school for all sorts of different reasons. And we had European social funding to work with those young people to use the performing arts to engage them in teaching and learning, predominantly English and maths, in a way that was new and different and was not about being taught in the traditional methods, but using performance poetry, dance and drama to help to improve young people's maths and English skills. Mm-hmm. And the demand for that activity was huge. And we had a big space to the left of the theatre where we thought, do you know what, we could do something really exciting here. And we started to talk about the notion of a teaching hospital for the performing arts, where young people could come into the professional environment of a theatre and learn the skills that they needed for a career in the performing arts. And we were just really ambitious about where we went to ask for the money and the hearts and minds that we needed to start changing to bring people on board with this idea that we needed to build a big extension to the Lyric. And it needed to be an extension and a capital project that was absolutely about engaging children, young people and their families in the performing arts and the opportunities that were available. And we were good at it.
Brilliant.
We were good at raising money. Yeah. And because of the way that policy was changing at that time and the idea to look for very specific new examples of teaching and learning, I do really feel that we had the right idea at the right time, and that policy and government, both locally and nationally, were aligned with our own ambition. And that was a really positive moment for us.
How did you see the integration of those educational components within the arts venues contributing to the skills development of the next generation of performing arts?
Oh, my goodness. Big question.
Big question.
Yeah. I just think that what I am most passionate about, you know, I do this sort of strange job. You'll get it. You're a chief executive too. You know, most of the time you have a sense of the direction you're going, and then you'll most likely have days where you think, what is my job? It's very unspecific some of the time. But what I always have to remind myself is ultimately, you know, my job is that I'm just the current custodian of Theatre Royal Plymouth. My job is to ensure that I hand it on to someone at some point in the future. And more what I care about is the ability to know that there is a generation of people underneath me or below me or younger than me that want to do it.
Yeah.
And I want that generation that is coming up behind me to be more experienced, better skilled, more diverse in all the ways that diversity can be understood. I want more working class young people to understand that the performing arts is a place where they can be and be valued. It is imperative that teaching and learning and skills and education has some form of performing arts embedded in it.
Yeah.
But we need places like City College Plymouth to continue to value the performing arts and that diversity of learning that the performing arts can give to you. And what we know is that those skills are so transferable. They help you to be a confident, creative person, and creativity and confidence is key to business success.
Now, let's focus on career choices. We'll be hearing more from Robert Halfon as well as Dame Kelly Holmes. But first, TV presenter turned life coach Anna Williamson, who reassured us that changing career paths is okay.
When they say in the future that people are going to change their jobs every few years and the skills for the future are going to be completely different to what they are today, and we don't even know what that looks like, we've been socially conditioned into a linear journey, haven't we? And nobody has a linear journey in life. And what you've just explained is a fantastic example of that, isn't it? So it's okay for people to change their minds, isn't it?
It's crazy, really, and how much pressure to be in the infancy of life, the very starting blocks of what do you want to do with your career? You know, what do you want to do in life? I mean, God willing, we have a long life ahead of us. So to be 16, 17, 18, and suddenly go, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? How big a question is that? If someone asked me that when I was, well, they did, obviously, because I knew what I liked. I knew what I was good at. And typically as well, back then, you know, 20 odd years ago, just suddenly say to my careers advisor, you know, at school, I'd like to be a pop star. I'd like to be a TV presenter. I'd like to be a podcast broadcaster, you know, with over 1 million listeners a month. I mean, it didn't exist. You were told you're absolutely bonkers. Go and do a proper job. Go and be a lawyer, doctor, whatever. And it's important to live in the present. I'm a life coach, as you say, amongst many things within that sphere. But, you know, I often teach people about short-term, medium-term and long-term goals. And I think that's a really helpful strategy to follow because it can be less overwhelming. Mm. And it's so overwhelming. You know, it's so much emphasis in place on making that right decision now. And when you've got it, you must stick to it. It doesn't work like that. Exactly as you say, Jackie, we're not linear and certainly not anymore. And I think that's great because as we move through life, we do change, we do evolve, we do have different life experiences, which can pivot us in a completely different direction. Look at me. I was 25 years old. I was on the telly. I mean, I have a bit of a random career, really, but I'd gone into the music industry and then I'd gone into TV. Then I had a mental breakdown in my early 20s. And then I started training in something because I was interested in it. And I think that's the best foundation. Do the job, do the thing, do the training that you have a passion for. Okay. And then if it becomes your living and you make money from it, then that's just a double win. But I think the best job satisfaction comes with life satisfaction when you are doing the thing because inherently you love doing it. We're not all that fortunate. I get it. But we all do have a choice. I meet a lot of people that limit themselves and block themselves. It's typically later in life. Oh, well, I can't do anything else now. I've hit a certain age and I'm working in this rubbish job that I hate. And I just try and encourage them to loosen that thinking, because if you have that thinking, then sure, you won't change. You will just stay in there and you will be fed up for the rest of your life. But what could you do? You know, what resources are available to you? And if that motivation is strong enough to just explore what else might be there, then you will experience it.
One of the things that Matt had spoken about was a desire to adapt Lord of the Flies.
Oh.
And to specifically adapt Lord of the Flies, where we would produce the show in cities all over the UK, but we would go to those cities 6 months in advance and find a company of boys and young men, many of whom who had never danced before, to be in the show with the professional dancers.
Mm.
And I just totally got it. And I understood how powerful that could be as a project. And so I wrote a funding application for £1.4 million to Arts Council England to deliver that project. And we got the money.
Wow.
And from about 2012 until about 2015, that was a life-changing experience for me. I basically felt like I lived on a Virgin Pendolino for 3 years, going all over the country, working with communities, identifying local dance talent to go into schools and colleges and young offenders institutes, sexual health clinics, you name it. We went there to find boys and young men who'd never danced before. And we then put together this amazing, huge production with the best creative team in the world. Olivier Award-winning creative team made that show, and we presented it in 14 cities around the UK. We work with over 400 boys and young men across the country. I remember every city was different, but I remember really vividly a story here in Plymouth of a lad who was in his teens, and he showed some real promise as a dancer, but he'd never danced in his life and was sort of corralled into going to the workshop by friends or by teachers. And then he got selected to be in the show. But what we didn't know was that the weekend before, he'd also been offered a place in the England under-16s rugby team.
Oh, my goodness.
And he had to choose. He had to choose whether or not he pursued a career as a rugby player or as a dancer.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, of course, I felt really strongly that he should come and be with us. And he did choose to come and be in the show. And he has just become a star. He's just done a 24-month contract playing the lead in Dirty Dancing in the West End.
Oh, wow.
This is a boy from Ivy Bridge.
Yeah.
Who'd never danced before. And now he's one of the most in-demand West End stars. And that's just a great story, isn't it? It just goes to show.
Does that make you feel good?
Yeah, it makes me feel good. Yeah. And for every story like that, there's sort of a couple in every city around the country. And yeah, I just love seeing what those young men are now doing.
How would you inspire the next generation of political leaders?
Well, I was a very strange child because I decided to be an MP when I was 10 years old. and the reason was because an MP came to my school and said the Houses of Parliament had 1,000 rooms. And I demanded to see every single room. I was taken to the House of Commons. I wasn't shown 1,000 rooms, but I just thought it was the most incredible place on earth. And I decided to do it. There was another reason for public services because of what happened to me with my legs and Great Ormond Street Hospital. I wanted to do public service. And I know people have a view about MPs, but the fact is, if you are an MP, you have to serve your constituency and look after your constituency, whether it's supporting skills and apprenticeships or infrastructure or making the case for Harlow in Parliament or whatever it might be. And I felt it's a way of giving something back. And I've done it for a very long time now. I was elected in 2010, but I'd fought two elections before that. So I was a parliamentary candidate since the end of 1999. So it's been a long, long time. So it's been a privilege to do it, but it's an inspirational profession. It has its downsides, of course, and you read a lot about that in the media, but you have a privilege of representing your community in Parliament. You have a privilege in standing up for the things you believe in, like, as I say, I've made my life's work in Parliament, apprenticeships and skills, and there can't be many professions that allow you to do that.
We're recording in Plymouth today, which is Britain's ocean city, and there's a huge naval base.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people locally that want to go into the services. There's an intergenerational service population. So can we talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, service life is amazing because you do. You learn so much about yourself and the opportunities are immense.
Mm.
And the thing is with service life is there are so many opportunities to do so many roles and so many jobs within that. And what that enables is that actually there's something for everybody. So you're not excluded from certain things, like maybe in society or in corporates that you might be excluded about if you feel that you haven't got the skill set to do a certain role in a job. Some people are so scared of going for an interview. I mean, I wouldn't even like to go for an interview to be, you know, going for an interview. And that will put people off of actually pushing themselves because they think, well, you know, what do I say? How do I say? What do I do? How do I dress? First of all, you've got to be yourself. You know, a lot of people like you as a person coming as your truth. But in the services, I think what they do is they really teach you how to do your role. So you go in and here, Navy, I was Army, but everybody does basic training. And during that basic training, you learn how to become a service person. And everybody starts at ground zero. Because on day one, when you go in and you're given your uniform and you're told where to go, it does not matter what qualifications as such you did that were academic at school. No one cares. You just got to be on time,
yep,
in your uniform. That is smart. And do exactly what you're told. Be on drill. Be wherever it is. So in basic training, that levels the playing field. So then what comes out is attitude and behaviours. What comes from it is, are you being astute? Are you listening to what is being given to you and what's expected of you? Are you taking that on board? Are you being a really good comrade? Are you being a real good team player?
Yeah.
Whatever's been given to you, have you processed that and said, right, this is what is expected? And the good thing in, I think, in service life is you know what's expected. In the real world, let's say outside of service life, sometimes you don't know what's expected of you. So you're trying to fulfill a role that somebody's give you without actually being told, right, we expect you in this job to act like this, be like this, look like this, say this. In the military, you know it quite quickly. So for me, that's the difference between service life and non-service life. When you're a young person, is when you go and you sign up, you will know and learn very quickly. So no one is excluded from that world.
Yeah.
And you then have your own aspirations. What do you want to do? What's your role? What's your job? Where do you want to get to? And it's very clear. It's hard work, like everything in life. Outside of service life, maybe it's not as clear, and that's where people feel like they're a little bit intimidated by their position. When you go into work, you're 17 and you see these people who are established and their roles, and you think, you know, where do I start? And I think that's really if you're not going into a specific role that's got real high academic requirements, because if you do that, then you know what your role is because you've learnt it. You've gone to college or university and you've learnt that role and you go and you put into a job and a position, but that's all the training you've done. So I think for me, mostly it's like go into anything and be with the impression that you're there to learn. So then when I became an athlete, it's very black and white. So everything else is subjective. Somebody else telling me I could be good at school. Somebody else telling me if I was good enough to pass the qualification. Whereas in sport, if I put in the work and I did the training and I knew that to be a world-class athlete, I'm going to have to reach this time in a race or to qualify for a championship, I've got to get in the first three at the national championships. They're the barriers. So I've got to get in the first three so I know what I've got to do to get there. Because the only way to get into the top three is to run a certain time. And if I don't do the training to run a certain time, I don't get anywhere. So that was easy to go, right, I've got to train hard. And that would take hours and hours, days and days, weeks and weeks, months and months to reach a standard, to get to that selection, to go to that national championships, to get to the top three, to qualify for a major champs. So I knew exactly what I could do.
Yeah.
And if you think of an athlete with a coach, the coach is writing a strategy. So they're writing a timetable and it's Monday to Sunday and it's an AM and a PM. And there's a session here and a session there and a run and a weights training and a recovery and this. And then you get to the session and then it's the warm up and the session and the cool down. And then you get to the session and it's how many reps you've got to do, how much recovery you've got to do. It's like broken down to literally the millisecond of what you've got to do. But most people will see anyone that's done well and perform is they just see it on the track. So they're going to see whether I win or lose.
Yeah.
No one sees the work behind anyone that's been successful. So everybody has to remember that behind anyone's success could be years. It could be so much work. But I think when you're young, you see people who are successful and think you could just do it with a click of the fingers sometimes. And that social media aspect that you brought in, it gives a false impression of what people can have done in their lives.
Yeah.
Rather than thinking, right, what do I have to do to be good? So when I was an athlete without all that, and my mental resilience was push myself to be good. If I didn't succeed the first time, pick myself up and go again.
Yeah.
The results came. Once the results come, you go, oh my God, I've done it. And then you go, what's the next thing? And you push yourself again. So at the beginning, my thing was always really positive.
Yeah.
Push. Then I started getting injuries.
Yeah.
And when you get injuries, that then almost like dents that self-preservation when you think, oh, I'm doing really well and you get an injury and it all feels like it's going wrong. And I always remember thinking around me, when I got injured, I'd go, well, I know how to run. So that's fine. What do I need to do to get better? But I still got to stay focused.
Mm-hmm.
I still got to stay energized. I still got to stay fit. So I used to just find my other skills, transferable skills. So they were go in the gym, go in the pool, go on the stepper, go on the bike, do weight training, have treatment. As soon as my injury's gone, I'm back running. I know how to run. So you have to remember the good things that you're good at.
Finally, let's look at the rapidly moving world of technology. We'll hear more from Anna Williamson, as well as AI educator Dan Fitzpatrick. But first, let's hear from entrepreneur Ben Towers, who launched his web design business at the age of just 11.
I'm sat here trying to imagine you, Ben Towers, at the age of 11. What was going on in your mind and what was going on to make you even be this person?
Yeah, I actually think my answer comes back to almost the name of the show as well. You know, I think the skills and the thing that's really important from a really young age and reflection that I've always had was I've always gone, why? Everything in my whole life, I've always questioned why. And sometimes that absolutely annoying my parents loads, sometimes annoying my teachers. But in reality, that was just always how I thought. And so when I was 11, I remember I was looking at computers and I got to give him my first one for my granddad. It was a really, really old one. I was playing with it and I was like, why? Or how does that work? Or why this and why that? And that basically got me excited into the space. And then I then started to go to secondary school and I was starting to then think, actually, can I build a website? Can I give it a go? And I started to build websites in my bedroom just out of curiosity. There was no thought of business. There was no thought of anything financial. It was purely this idea that this is fun. Why can't I? And then over time, you know, that then became the company. And on reflection now, I actually think that's the best way to start a business, to do something you're genuinely passionate about and you enjoy, and then the money will follow.
Have you got any views or any advice on how we can develop ourselves to our full potential using or through social media?
Social media, I think, is an amazing invention. It gets a lot of stick as well. And I think it's important to be really boundaried around social media. I have a social media presence. It's a huge part of what I do. It's a huge part of my reach. It's a huge part of my industry and my business. We all know social media can be highly addictive and it's very influential. I think it's really important to really ask yourself the question of, what am I using social media for? How can I use it to my advantage? What do I do that I can benefit by using social media? And curating whatever it is you're doing in order to tap into your target audience, you know, who you want to speak to. Also, the main thing about social media, it is highly filtered and we should always take it with a pinch of salt in what someone's posting and everything else. But what is in vogue now is the word authenticity. So just be your best authentic self. Don't pretend to be like so-and-so on your grid who is probably not even that person. They've created a filter. Be you, unapologetically you. What you're into, what you look like, what you stand for, what your values are, you will attract similar people who want to tap into you for being you. So don't have this feeling that you need to appeal to everybody, because you won't, probably not. And that's okay. But who do you appeal to? Focus on who you are wanting to attract to your social media and for what reasons. And I think also filtering out people or pages and things that make you feel rubbish, I think, is a really important thing as well. So you can block out certain words if certain things come through that you don't like. Really curate your social media to your advantage and what you do and don't want to see.
AI can aid opening up the community so it's fit for all to understand.
I think it's one of the really cool things that's happening in AI at the moment, although it still needs a lot of development, is AI wearable technology. So when I give a talk, I wear a pair of sunglasses, which were made by Meta, the company behind Facebook, and Ray-Ban. It's got AI integrated into them. It's got a camera on it. You can say to it, look at this. What am I looking at? One of my sisters, she had an illness recently. Now she's mainly blind, and I keep talking to her about this technology because I think it's going to be incredible for accessibility for people with disabilities. I think it's going to really transform a world, really, when you're not having to have a person continually with you explaining everything to you, but actually the technology can step in and do that. And I think there's something around dignity there as well, of giving that dignity back.
As an educationist, that's what I was thinking through also. And in terms of supporting neurodiversity, I mean, there's a myriad of things that can aid, support and develop, isn't there?
100%. And there's some crazy technology happening at the moment. And so I try to not do the crystal ball thing with it.
Yeah.
But there are some technologies actually being worked on at the moment that I think are going to absolutely revolutionize what we do. So one of them is what's referred to as brain technology. In fact, last year, Osaka University in Japan, what they did was they wanted to train an AI model on images. What would normally happen there is you'd find lots and lots of images, you'd upload them to the AI, and you would label the images so that the AI could learn what was in the images. Except what they did was they didn't show the images to the AI. What they did was they give them to four human participants, and they had to just look at them. And while they were looking at them, they did MRI scans of their brains. And it was the MRI scan images that they gave to the AI. Now, after a while, the AI started to get really good at being able to guess the type of image that the person was looking at.
Wow.
Then what they did was, a bit like a magician, they said, right, to the participants, put all the images down, close your eyes, and think of an image in your head, any image you want. And they did that. Did an MRI scan, they give it to the AI, and they asked the AI to recreate the images. And they're about 80% accurate. This is a year ago of what they're thinking of. Berkeley University in America did similar recently, where they measured the brain activity of somebody listening to a Pink Floyd song, give it to the AI, and the AI recreated the audio of the song. So there's some big implications with technology. There's a university in Abu Dhabi at the minute making the world's first thought-to-text tool. So you think it, and it'll write it down for you. And then if you kind of pair that with what Elon Musk is doing at Neuralink, which is installing small computer devices into people's brains, the technology that we already have starts to get really crazy. And in fact, they've just trialed at Neuralink using this technology with somebody who's paralyzed. So they installed it. What it does is it allows them to move the cursor, use the keyboard on a computer, control a computer just with their thoughts. So this guy can do so much now just with his thoughts. And if you go to YouTube and you search Neuralink first patient, you'll find videos of him explaining how he just literally thinks about moving the cursor on the screen and it moves. So the whole kind of brain tech side of this technology that we already have, this is not going, let's imagine what if this technology could do this or that. This is what we already have, is going to change things. Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI, the people who created ChatGPT, he thinks that within about 2 years now, because of this technology, we'll probably get prototypes of the first bits of technology that will allow humans to communicate with each other just through thought.
God.
The flip side of that is not AI integrating with our biology, but it's AI getting its own body. Robots that essentially have the mind of a tool like ChatGPT, so you can have an intellectual conversation with it. The Tesla Optimus Generation 2, if you go have a look at that on YouTube, it's just phenomenal. And they're going to be putting them to work in their factories very soon. And their aim is that within 3 years, anybody will be able to buy one of these for about the price of a family-sized car. Literally within the next, let's say, 5 years, people are going to have robots in their house, cleaning their houses, making their dinner, doing the dishes. Not only that, but you'll be able to have a conversation with it over dinner. And this is stuff that we've got already. The consumer side of that is really cool, and I love thinking about what we're going to have. But going back to what we were just discussing, the ability to help people who have got certain needs with this technology is just going to be phenomenal.
Wow.
How people are going to be able to communicate, people who could never communicate beforehand, or who've lost ability to communicate, or have special educational needs that means they can't express themselves in certain ways. People who are housebound, if you look at the creaking healthcare system in the UK, we could have robotic technology that could help people.
Skillfully Speaking is supported by Babcock International. Visit babcockinternational.com. Presented by Jackie Grubb. Produced by Paul Philpott. Production support by Lisa Hartwell. Edited and mixed by Martin Burgess Moon. Video content by Mark Stevenson. Coordinated by Louise Greenleaf. Produced by Fresh Air Studios. Copyright City College Plymouth, all rights reserved.